from UALR Public Radio and the Argenta Arts Foundation. This is Tales from the South.
He is survived by his parents, who remain baffled as to why he drove the 1962 John Deere into that trench to begin with. And his brother Michael, lone heir to the family farm by virtue of his ability not to kill himself with runaway equipment.
Recorded in front of a live audience at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas.
The feeding cattle, startled, jerked their heads back through the fence and stared at me. From where I was, I could see nothing but boards and cattle. But I could hear Mom calling to me still, George! I rolled onto my hands and knees, then scrambled through the fence.
Each week, it's an intimate dinner with everyday Southerners on our unrehearsed show, telling their story, as if they were sitting on the porch with you.
I decided to survey the room, and when I did, my mouth gaped. Every girl was sitting legs wide open, flashing men's boxer shorts under those beautiful plaid skirts.
So sit back, relax, and reconnect with the power of a story. Now, let's go live to Tales from the South.
Know that you're mine, 'cause you are me all of the time. Come on, take your dress off. I will put some music on. We're gonna do this thing for sure. Come on, take your duds off. Oh yeah, I'm gonna put some music on. Well, you're gonna do this thing for sure.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by Tiffany Christopher? What'd y'all think? CDs for sale after the show, and more can be found out about Tiffany at tiffanychristopher.com. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to another edition of Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and tonight's show is sponsored by William F. Lehman Public Library, all right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Morell. On my left here, strumming his 1931 National Resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? What do y'all think about our set? These genuine screen doors from the Arkansas Delta with mixed media portraiture are by esteemed Arkansas artist V.L. Cox from her Images of the American South collection. A portion of the proceeds from the sale of these works goes to Tales from the South. More can be seen at her website, greatfineart.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern style storytelling? Tonight, we have the pleasure of presenting the top three stories from our second annual Telling Tales contest in conjunction with the 2012 Arkansas Literary Festival and sponsored by William F. Lehman Public Library. Writers were asked to write their literary memoirs based on this quote by Graham Greene: "There is always one moment in childhood when the door opens and lets the future in. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who live them." Later tonight, Sarah Mitchell's door opens at a private girls' school with eye-opening consequences. And we'll end the night with George Mader as he stands on the cusp of a boy's decision. But let's start the night with Eric Van Meter as he sits on top of a tractor and eyes his own boyhood mortality in Ride It Out.
So this is it, I thought from atop the tractor. This is how 13-year-old Eric Van Meter dies. Not in heroic defense of a beautiful girl or in valiant battle against the forces of darkness, but in a tangle of brush and metal at the bottom of a ditch in the middle of a hayfield. He is survived by his parents, who remain baffled as to why he drove the 1962 John Deere into that trench to begin with. And his brother Michael, lone heir to the family farm by virtue of his ability not to kill himself with runaway equipment. I wondered who would come to my funeral. The imminent threat to my survival was a deep ditch 50 feet in front of me. I'd played in it when I was a little boy, climbing its near vertical sides by pulling on the roots that grew out of and then back into its walls. I couldn't say that I'd overlooked it or forgotten it was there. The truth was that, lost in thought while raking hay for my father, I'd gotten the tractor moving a little too fast down a hill. The brakes wouldn't stop it. Cutting the wheels would flip it. I was going down, and the tractor and rake were going with me. And Dad, who was baling hay across the creek, was too far away to see, much less help. I was on my own. 40 feet. 35. If God is truly merciful, I thought, there will at least be an explosion. Something akin to Die Hard or The Terminator. If he's going to allow a good kid like me to perish in a stupid farm accident, the least he could do was mark the event with a ball of fire and plume of black smoke. I hoped I would see it as my spirit rose heavenward. Need a miracle, I muttered in perhaps the most earnest prayer of my life. I lifted my feet onto the tractor seat and glanced back, trying to gauge my chances of clearing the rear tires and hay rake. But I was a fat kid, and not at all athletic. My only chance, and a slim chance at that, was to ride it out. I dropped into the seat and held the wheel. Dad's going to kill me, I thought. Earlier that summer, my family began to openly suspect that I was victim to a genetic mutation that turned me against farming, or at least against farm equipment. Even though I'd already been driving for half my life, I'd begun to display an alarming knack for vehicular destruction. The old pickup I had used to feed cattle looked like the loser in a demolition derby. I had ruined lawnmowers, broken hay rakes, and nearly taken down the oldest barn on the place in a sequence of misjudgments I don't care to revisit. My mother tried to defend me, citing my age and overactive imagination. Neither excuse was quite enough for my father, who had done all the farm work I had done and more by my age, yet without the litany of accidents. He thought I needed to toughen up, to learn a little responsibility, to get my head back in the real world. Give him time, was all my mother could say. Dad didn't answer. He tried whatever he could to think of to make me a better farmhand. He coached me before every trip into the field. He tried putting me on the best tractor we owned, a Russian-made cab tractor he'd purchased at a discount. When I couldn't work the Soviet block gears, he put me on the simplest tractor. When I broke that one down, he limited me only to the most expendable machinery. Nothing helped. I gashed the front tires on a barbed wire fence that I swear materialized as I was driving across the pasture. I made another attempt on the old barn that I never fully confessed. When I finally did get into an open field to work the hay, I left patterns that looked like failed crop circles. Ones drawn by particularly dumb aliens who had also been drinking at the time. But what else could my father do? He was trying to raise me to be a good and responsible kid, the kind of boy everyone would be proud of. The farm was, to him, the pathway to manhood. Besides, it required help from everyone in the family, regardless of the quality of that help. And the truth was that everything within me wanted not to be inept. I wanted my father's approval, and if I couldn't have it for what I was good at, then maybe I could earn it by being good at what he cared about. Yet here I was, racing toward my doom, mere seconds from what could be my last and most spectacular farm failure. 10 feet. I gripped the metal steering wheel.
It jerked violently beneath my hands. The old seat bounced me onto the floorboard, but I held onto the wheel as I slid down. I couldn't see anything but the yellowed gauges on the console now, but the tractor continued to kick around like a rodeo bull. Then all at once, the ride smoothed out again. I pulled myself back into the seat and managed to depress the clutch and brake. The tractor rolled to a stop, held upright, I was sure, by the hand of God. When I turned around, I saw where the tires had gouged the dirt as I came through. The rake was still attached to the tractor, albeit with a few broken teeth and a suspicious-looking bulge in the axle. I found a clearing in this new field and tested it out. It whirled unevenly and produced a grating metal-on-metal sound. More destruction. What else would anyone expect? No one dives into the abyss and emerges unscathed. I looked across the creek. Dad's tractor chugged along, rolling the hay into perfect round bales. He hadn't noticed my ride into the ditch, nor the busted equipment. There was no point going over to tell him now. I steered toward the house and started getting my story ready. And the more I thought about it, the more I liked this story, fear of death notwithstanding. I could already see the possibilities in its telling, the metaphors it offered. I would enjoy telling it to my friends and probably even to my mother. Dad, however, would not want a metaphorical version of this story. He would request facts, and then he would respond. He would yell, and that would be all right, because it would arise from a fear of loss, of separation. The same fears haunted me. But that ending was already set in motion, rolling downhill and nothing to stop it. That's how it goes with fathers and sons. The lucky ones among us make it out alive. Dad's tractor rumbled along in the distance, following the windrows he'd laid a few hours before. It diminished in size with every revolution of my wheels toward home. I wondered how long it would take him to notice that I was gone.
Eric Van Meter is a writer and campus minister at Arkansas State University in Jonesboro. He and his wife, Denise, have two sons, Zachary and Jonathan. He is still not allowed to drive his dad's tractors. In our next story, Sarah Mitchell stands in the doorway of an elite high school and sees more than she bargained for in On Being a Lady.
Mom was frazzled. When she worried, she'd chew her nails down to the quick. If it dealt with her kids, she'd chew till they bled. "Don't mess this up," she chided. "You know how important it is." "To whom?" I boldly asked. "Don't you sass me. This school is going to teach you to be a lady." Mom had grown tired of her only daughter playing sports and running outdoors. She longed to see me in a white debutante dress, hair in ringlets, and fully made up. "A true lady," she repeated again, before dropping me at the elite all-girls prep school in town on a future student visit. It was 1994, and I was in eighth grade preparing for high school. This was the school, the land of the plaid, as my brother and I referred to it, and it was my mother's dream. The school where the wealthy girls went and the wealthy boys went for dates. The school where drama and the arts were encouraged instead of shop and home ec. The school where you could pick the college of your dreams instead of pray for acceptance to state. The school Mom didn't have a shot at. Mom grew up with little and had to learn responsibility early on. Her childhood involved helping to raise her three younger siblings, while my single grandmother tried to feed 5 mouths on a meager government salary. Mom worked hard making straight A's because she had to, and she came home in the afternoons to dirty diapers, supper preparation, and house cleaning. Mom watched the girls in their plaid skirts, starched white cotton shirts, and saddle Oxfords, skipping to school with thoughts of only boys, dances, and dresses in their heads. This was not her childhood, but she was determined to make it her only daughter's. This was actually Mom's second attempt at getting me here. I had held my ground and fought hard to attend my current co-ed institution for junior high, but this was high school, and this was serious. Mom was the one standing her ground this time, and she wasn't going to go down easy. My schedule for the visit included a laundry list of the school's popular course offerings. There was speech, drama, dance, and the course I was most looking forward to, literature. At my school, we called it English, but here it was literature. Even course subjects were more esteemed. Entering literature, I chose a seat near the front of the room, close enough to be nerdy, but not the first row like a complete nerd. "Welcome, Sarah," Ms. Collins said. "We are glad you could visit today." I'm sure she could smell the anticipation on me. "Today is going to be a reading day," Ms. Collins proceeded. "Once a week, we have a day where students get to enjoy literature at their own pace. Grab a book and find a place to sit on the furniture or the floor." I couldn't mask my disappointment. Hanging my head, I sauntered to the shelf, choosing the smartest-looking book I could find. The popular girls had already commandeered the lone love seat and overstuffed chairs. I was relegated to the floor. Mom's words echoed in my head. "Be a lady. How does a lady sit on the floor?" Not only was I embarrassed to be the only girl out of uniform, but worse, Mom had chosen my outfit for the day, an uncomfortable short, tight wrap skirt and matching chop. I have no idea why she found it necessary for me to wear a short skirt to an all-girls school, but it had not been up for discussion. It was difficult enough scooting into a desk, lacking the movability of the cheerleader-like pleated plaid skirts, but the floor? I found a bare spot near the wall, and sweat seeped from every pore in my body. Lady. I leaned against the wall and slowly slid my back down the smooth paint, bending my knees like I was squatting in tennis practice. I got as close to the floor as humanly possible, wincing at the burn in my thighs, and placed my left palm down to cushion the thud that was about to occur. As it did, I deftly kicked my legs, ankles crossed like a lady, at a 45-degree angle behind my body. Success. No flashing had occurred, and only minimal bruising would appear later. I smiled and silently congratulated myself. Mom would be so proud. I decided to survey the room, and when I did, my mouth gaped. Every girl was sitting legs wide open, flashing men's boxer shorts under those beautiful plaid skirts. There were paisleys and stripes and polka dots, and some seemed to have themes with fish or Disney characters. They were in all stages of wear, some so new it looked as though the tag had been snipped on the way to school, and some so terribly tattered they looked to be hand-me-downs from a father or boyfriend. There were legs draped over furniture in every angle of askew, and skirts bunched up around hips, all in an effort to get prominently displayed boxers. These were ladies? I was confused. "How was your day?" Mom attempted to sound casual when I climbed in the car at 3 p.m. "If those girls are ladies, then I don't want to be one," I proclaimed. Mom was crestfallen, but I shouldered on, determined to make my point. At lunch, the girls told me that you can't eat for 2 days before the Friday night football games because you have to look thin for the boys. And you can't order French fries at the cafeteria unless you want to get called fatty behind your back. I couldn't stop. In the winter, they have contests to see who can grow their leg hair the longest. Last year's winner went 2 months, Mom. And then, my nail in the coffin, I licked my lips. And they wear boxer shorts under their skirts and sit around with their legs spread to show them off. Silence. I had pushed it too far. I had ruined her dreams for me and for her. Her face showed disappointment and disbelief. I felt sick at my stomach. And then, strangely, Mom started laughing, harder than I'd ever heard her laugh before. A tear was even forming in one eye. "Boxer briefs?" she asked me dubiously. "You have to be teasing me." Mom, it was crazy. And then I shamelessly began imitating the different reclining pose I had witnessed in the literature class. I slumped in the passenger chair of the car and kicked one leg up on the dashboard. I sat Indian style. I sat with my ankle resting on the opposite knee like the boys did. Anything to keep Mom laughing. Finally, the laughter subsided. "Mom, really, if you want me to go, I'll go. It wasn't that bad. Do you want to go?" I couldn't respond. I didn't have the heart. "We'll talk about it later," she relented. We drove down that long, winding drive, passing the stacked stone walls in complete silence. Pausing under the imposing black iron entrance gate, we both knew this would be our last visit to the land of the plaid. Mom slowly turned the car toward home, and we never looked back.
Sarah Mitchell is originally from Nashville, Tennessee, but now calls Little Rock home. She is a graduate student in the Rhetoric and Writing program at the University of Arkansas at Little Rock. This is her second appearance on Tales from the South. In our final story of the night, George Mader climbs the ladder of a 14-year-old boy, but leaves a piece of childhood behind in Defining Moment.
I climbed the ladder to the top of the haystack. I stood, my feet 16 feet above the ground, and looked out over the farm. Even on this gloomy November late afternoon, I enjoyed the view. The hay fields were pleasingly bare, and the stack of bales on which I stood was a testament to hard work done months earlier. Bringing my gaze back into the cattle yard below, I flinched as the change in focus gave me a sense of vertigo. I was 14, but I had not outgrown my fear of heights, and with the exceptions of the roof of the barn and the very peak of the two-story farmhouse, this was the highest perch on the farm. The haystack was in a corner of our cattle yard, beyond a wooden feeding fence my father had built years before I was born. Stout wooden posts and thick planks formed a 3-foot wall. Above that was a gap through which the cattle could feed, then more boards to keep them from jumping the fence. I yanked loose a bale and trudged unevenly to a corner of the stack. From that corner, I heaved the bale into the air, a perfect throw. Not only did I get it far out from the stack, of course, my father and older brothers could have thrown it much farther, I also got it to land right next to the fence. The bale landed flat, too, so that the force of the landing caused the encircling twines to snap and the bale to break apart, ready for the cattle to eat. Several of them did just that, hurrying forward and pushing their heads through the fence, jostling for position to feed. I heard the distinctive rattle of the metal gate at the far end of the cattle yard. I looked up and out over the cattle to see Mom enter and begin to cross toward the haystack. She wore her brown chore coat and a kerchief. Her trousers were tucked into her overshoes. She had been watering the calves in the barn and now was coming to help me feed the cattle. She would cut the twines from the bales I threw down and distribute the hay farther along the fence. I turned away and walked back across the stack to get the next bale. I felt guilty about Mom helping me with the chores. After all, she was 58 years old. But I was the only child still at home, and her help allowed us to finish the chores between the time I got home from school and Dad's return from his carpentry job. Dad was already getting up at 4 o'clock to do the morning milking, and he had plenty of farm work to do at night. The sooner he and I did the evening milking, the more sleep Dad got. It was that simple. I pulled loose another bale and started again toward the corner of the stack. I had almost reached it when I heard Mom yell, "Get away!" I looked up to see Drummer, the biggest and meanest cow in the herd, over 1,400 pounds, leap and buck her head into Mom's side. In that instant of impact, I saw my mother's body slackly draped over Drummer's skull. She flew through the air for an instant before landing and tumbling across the yard. More butting blows from Drummer sent Mom rolling by like a bundle of rags. She called out, "George, help!" I dropped the bale I was holding and stood straight. As my heart gave one gigantic hammer blow to my chest, I turned and looked back across the stack toward the ladder. I took the remaining stride to the corner of the haystack and jumped. I leapt out, aiming to reach the broken bale that might absorb some of the impact of my landing and hoping, as I flew through the air, to miss the heavy boards of the fence. Out and down I went, my arms windmilling and my legs splayed one in front of the other until I brought them together as I neared the ground. I landed heavily in a squat on the broken bale, then tumbled backward. The feeding cattle, startled, jerked their heads back through the fence and stared at me. From where I was, I could see nothing but boards and cattle. But I could hear Mom calling to me still, "George!" I rolled onto my hands and knees, then scrambled through the fence. "Get! Yeah!" The cattle backed a step and looked at me warily, stupidly, but did not clear a path. "Move!" I shoved with my shoulders on those nearest me, squeezing and swimming my way through the herd. When I finally burst free, I could see Mom and Drummer 30 yards away. Drummer's head was burrowed into Mom's chest, pinning her down and skidding her along the surface of the yard. Mom's head was craned forward up off the ground, and her fists were hammering at the top of Drummer's huge, thick-boned skull. She was still calling for me. I raced toward them, shouting with a volume I had not known I could generate, a volume made possible only by adrenaline and fear. Drummer stopped, and she shifted to face me, her head low over Mom's body. I continued straight at her and yelled again, trying to make my voice sound low. My last stride toward her was a leap into the air, shouting, flailing my arms, trying desperately to make myself seem somehow larger and menacing. Just as I landed in front of Drummer, my attempted manly shout ending in a childish, high-pitched scream. Drummer lifted her head, and I hit her hard on the side of her snout. The impact turned her head, and she wheeled away from me. I stepped over my mother and ran alongside Drummer, delivering blows to her side, keeping her moving. As Drummer broke into a run and pulled away from me, I turned back. Mom was on one knee, attempting to stand. I helped her to her feet, but she remained bent over, clutching her ribs. We walked slowly through the metal gate, keeping an eye on Drummer. As we neared the barn, we saw the bright brake lights on Dad's truck pulling into the garage. Mom told me she could get to the house all right, and with a warning for me to be careful, sent me back to finish the chores. I got a pitchfork from the barn and held it through the cattle yard to the haystack. I walked deliberately, hoping Drummer would come at me. I wanted an excuse to hurt her. She was far away, though, by the water trough where I had no reason to go. I climbed the ladder to the top of the haystack. There sat the bale I had dropped when I jumped. I threw down the rest of the hay, climbed down the ladder, and distributed the hay along the fence. When I was done, I stood, coiling the twines I had cut from the bales, and looked up to the top of the haystack, to the corner from which I had jumped. I stared for several seconds, and I thought about that moment, just before my leap, that defining moment, when, with my mother calling to me, I had hesitated.
George Mader grew up the youngest of seven children on a Midwestern dairy farm. He currently teaches at William H. Bowen School of Law here in Little Rock. His creative writing focuses on the humor, trials, and joys of small moments between people from small places. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? What y'all think? Thank you to all of our writers, thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Writer accommodations provided by Robin Wood Bed and Breakfast. Studio time by Infrared Studio Productions. Graphics by Robin Steves at Studio B. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.